Hello, and welcome to Evaluland. This is the show where we interview people about any and all things evaluation related. I am your host, Dana Jane Linnell, recording on the ancestral lands of the Anishinaabe people in Menominee, Wisconsin.
Well, hello, Brittany. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Hi, Dana. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you for coming. So tell us a little bit about who you are. What things come to mind about who you are, how you came into this evaluation journey space?
Sure. So I am a professor, a practitioner, a public speaker, an evaluator, a researcher. So I wear many hats depending on the day. I like to say that I stumbled my way into evaluation. To give the brief trajectory, in undergrad, I studied sociology and women and gender studies and was like fascinated by structures and systems and how that influences how we experience certain things in society. And then, since the last 15 or so years, have worked in domestic nonprofits, have worked for philanthropy doing evaluation, have worked in higher education, and at the Department of Defense here in the United States doing sexual assault research. And then currently I work for an international NGO doing mostly evaluation related impact measurement and strategy work. And so I've had this like kind of windy career through lots of different experiences. I would say I got into evaluation in a few different ways. One was my first master's degree. I'm one of those people who has way too many credentials. I was working in student affairs at a university and was doing my master's in public administration basically part-time on the side, evenings and weekends. And I took a class called Evaluation Capacity Building that was like an elective, and it seemed interesting. And I just loved it. Like, I found it really interesting to think about. And at that time, I'll say, I think what piqued my interest is I had spent some time in some nonprofits as well as an academic women's center where we were doing a lot of programming, and I always in the back of my head was like, we're just doing these like events and programs just to do them. Like, are they actually doing anything? Like, is anyone learning anything? Is the world getting better? And so I was fascinated in this evaluation class of thinking about, oh, there's actually a whole field around helping different groups and organizations and corporations like actually assess what they're doing and whether it's working and whether it's not. So I really enjoyed that particular class, but then life kind of went on and I decided to pursue my PhD and move to the Washington DC area, which is where I am now, to do my PhD in sociology at University of Maryland, and started doing some consulting on the side during my PhD program just to keep a foot outside of academia and honestly just like make a little bit of extra money while in grad school. And I ended up spending 4 or 5 years working for a foundation. And what it morphed into is really completely building out their learning and evaluation portfolio. So it started out as just doing some kind of analysis for them, looking at proposals and helping synthesize information. And then really just one of those things where I kept seeing needs and kept bringing them up. And it was a really great place where they were like, sure, you could do that. So by the time I left, we had actually built this really robust evaluation framework for their grant making and had really streamlined the application process aligned to their strategic goals. So it was really exciting. And then as I was finishing my PhD, I was thinking about next steps, and this was the height of the pandemic in 2020. Mm. And so, long story for another time, ended up turning down a tenure track job offer and deciding to go more of the practitioner route. And since then, have found myself in various research and evaluation spaces in different ways. And so, yeah, it's been really fun. I think if you had asked me, like, as an undergrad, do you want to work in research and evaluation? Mm-hmm. I would have said, like, A, what is that? And B, probably not. That sounds kind of boring. But it's where I've ended up and I really love it.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh. So many things about your background that I want to like probe into. The first one, I'm just like, where did you go for your master's degree that they had an ECB elective course, like the evaluation capacity building course?
I went to Grand Valley State University, which is also where I did my undergrad. And I was a staff member of the university. And Sal Alimo, who is still very involved in the evaluation space, taught that class and is a wonderful resource. But that is in West Michigan, which is not far from Western Michigan University, which obviously has a phenomenal evaluation. So I think we benefit a little bit from all the great evaluators in the area from Western.
Oh, that is so cool. Like, I think taking an ECV course to kind of get your feet wet into the evaluation space seems like such a great way to get in. I got to take one with Leslie Fierro, which was such a, you know, so much fun. I learned so much about the concept and practice of ECV. And I love that like learning development approach to evaluation as opposed to accountability and measurement approach.
Yes. And I think partly because of my pathway into evaluation, I'm an educator first. Like I've spent most of my career in academia and in higher education and as a professor. And so it's very much for me about that learning and like, what are we doing with the information? How are we improving? And I sometimes am confronted with people who come at it from a more of like a monitoring or accountability standpoint. And it always is still tends to surprise me just because that wasn't and isn't my own orientation to the work.
Yeah. And I think this episode is coming out after a previous episode that has not come out since the time of this, right? Like of us recording this, but we talked a lot about like these misconceptions of what evaluation is and how people think differently about what evaluation is, right? Like, I think there are some things that I would call misconceptions. And also there are just different ways people think about what evaluation is. So I'm maybe curious what your thoughts are. Like if you had to describe to perhaps a new client or somebody what evaluation is, why they should be doing it, what would you say?
Oh, that's such a good question. Okay, this is totally off the top of my head. So hopefully listeners don't hold me to this. But I think I would say something like, it's a way of assessing how what we're doing is working, whatever that is, right? Like working in whatever way, to what extent it's working, who it's working for, what are some unintended ways it's working or not working. But really, it's showing us the effectiveness of how something is operating. And then to me, that learning piece is so huge. Like, I know this is like turning into a multi-sentence definition, but like I would add something about like then how you're using that data. Like I think as a researcher and as an evaluator, my worst fear is people do all of this amazing analysis, work, data collection, like the whole thing. And it sits on a proverbial shelf, right? And in 2024, that often looks like it sits in like a folder on our Google Drive or our cloud or whatever. But it's sitting on an electronic shelf and no one's using it. And especially when I was doing some more work in philanthropy, I think a lot of times organizations are doing evaluations to check a box to meet the requirement for a funder or a donor. And I think that's it comes from a well-intentioned space. And I've been on both sides of it. I now work for an organization that gets a lot of government and private donation funding. You know, you want to do your due diligence of making sure you're meeting funding requirements, of course. And funders want to know that they're investing in programs that are working. And to your point, there's a level of accountability. But to me, what makes evaluation and research exciting is that learning piece. And if we're just doing it to fulfill a requirement and then we don't do anything with the information, it's just a huge missed opportunity.
Yeah. It's like, why were we even here in the first place? Right. It feels, I don't know. I agree. The checkboxy feel of the work we do sometimes is not the reason why I went into this. I wanted to be of service to organizations in the best way I can. And yeah, maybe I guess sometimes they just need somebody to do that checkbox for them, but I want it to be more than that.
Exactly. And I've been really trying to push our teams internally to think creatively about what the knowledge products or deliverables look like. I was just this morning reading a 65-page report based on a recent study we did internally, and it's full of fascinating findings with many tables and many graphs and like lots of words. But I am one of the few people who's partly because it's a project I've been in, like intimately involved with and leading. I am one of a handful of people who will from top to bottom read that 65-page report.
Right.
What we now need to do is take that 65-page report and turn it into a 10-slide PowerPoint that's mostly visuals, a 3-page executive summary that, you know, folks can read, perhaps do, you know, some other creative outlet around like blog posts, podcasts, etc. And so I've increasingly been trying to think of that full-length article or full-length report is the start, not the end. Like that is the start then of all like the knowledge dissemination and the learning, because it's everyone's busy, right? I don't fault individuals, but just like very few people have time to read every 65-page report that comes out because there's a lot of them.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is that those technical reports are for the other evaluators and researchers that want to look at them. They're not from the program themselves. And like you said, having a variety of deliverables can really help with the possibility, potential of use, like the executive summary, like a PowerPoint or a slide doc report type thing. I mean, people are even getting really creative. Not necessarily just in art spaces, but in youth spaces as well. I'm seeing more of like putting on a play or performance, or I've heard of people doing a comic book. And so like thinking about who your audience is and trying to align with the organization you're working with, I think is so critical. So critical.
Yeah.
It goes back to that capacity building stuff, right? Like, yeah.
It's the capacity building. And it's like, as part of my role, I've been doing some work with some women-led organizations around the world, and this whole movement around like decolonizing research and evaluation and knowledge production, and recognizing that the 65-page report version of knowledge is very Western and very white and very colonial. And that, as you were just giving examples of, there are like so many other ways that already exist in the world to share information. And, you know, I think we just need to be open to looking at those.
Yeah. Open and like understanding that they can be just as valuable. Cause I get the sense sometimes that it's just like, oh yeah, we'll do it. That's a nice add-on, but the report is what's most important. Right. And like, yeah. I mean, if you're working, for example, with like an Indigenous organization where storytelling and oral traditions are so critical, like, I don't think they want a report. Like maybe you need that and their funder needs that, but they don't probably want that. It really just goes back to talking with the stakeholders of what they want. Like sometimes I've had clients who really wanted that report and also that they've really used that report. But then I've also had ones that were like, yeah, I need the report, but then they don't do anything with it. It's like, well, let's step back. You said you wanted this report. And then every time you have questions, you're like, Dana, find the answer for me. And I'm like, well, it's in that report. and so like, okay, if that wasn't the deliverable that you actually wanted, let's step back and talk about what it is actually going to be useful for you. Cause like, as much as I want you to come back to me for support and guidance and everything like that, also like, I was going to talk to you about your professor work too, but I'm like, I just keep thinking it's in the syllabus.
Yes, having the same thought, like read the things that exist. But to me, that's a sign, like if they're coming back to you, were they just asking for a report on default? Because that's what they know they typically get and are not even aware that there are other ways we could be disseminating this knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Who is it? I think Kylie Hutchinson has a book on innovative evaluation reporting. And it's just like all of these ideas of how we could change things up. But having that conversation early on, it always reminds me of like the utilization focused evaluation approach by Michael Quinn-Patton, of how like you ought to be having these conversations at the start of like, what do they actually want to use this for? How are they going to like deal with any potential negative findings? Like those are some conversations I'd wish I'd had with some past clients. And then like, what would be most useful for them, like in terms of what that report will look like? So it's all this pre-work, like the pre-work to evaluation is like the such a critical part. And instead, I feel like we just jump into like, let's do the thing.
Right. Yeah, no, we do. And I think from an organizational learning standpoint, that pre-work is what takes it to that next level of analysis mm-hmm. of like, it's not just kind of checking the box. It's like from the beginning, setting this up for success, for usability and learning and like all the things we're going to do with it. So let's design it that way from the beginning. And often I just even know internally in my own organization, it's like, oh, well, we have this budget for the evaluation that has to be spent by the end of the fiscal year, like go, go, go. and sometimes just timelines, you know, again, it gets back to the bandwidth thing of like limited time, limited resources, but trying to push that is so important.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a couple of things you mentioned at the start that I want to talk a little bit about. So I'm also a professor. I teach at a polytechnic university, a primarily undergraduate university. But you mentioned that you turned down a tenure track position, which, not going to lie, I can totally understand the reason for doing that, especially at the pandemic. Teaching in the pandemic was rough. But it sounds like you're doing some like adjunct position work in teaching still.
I am off and on a bit. So I miss students and I miss the coaching and mentoring yeah. and advising that comes with working with students. So, oh goodness, 2 or 3 years ago now, I started teaching at George Washington University. Yes, as like an affiliated adjunct instructor. I've taught sociology of sex and gender a few times. I've taught a sociology of education class. So actually not technically research or evaluation specific, but it's just, it's for me, it's like fun to still get to wear that hat. I recently moved a bit farther outside of DC to West Virginia. So have been like looking around at now my new local universities to see if anyone might need something, but I've not actually taught an evaluation class and I'm interested in it. So I'm also, you know, open to, doesn't have to be in sociology or gender studies, but getting into more of that, like teaching practitioner focus of what does it look like to do this work? Because as we talked about, I took a couple of evaluation classes in a previous graduate program and they planted some seeds that have definitely come into fruition many years later.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, I'm in a psychology department, so I do teach some psychology courses, but I'm more of an applied researcher, so I teach more of like research methods and statistics and then also the evaluation class.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah, I agree. I think teaching is so fun. When all the stars align, it's glorious. And sometimes the stars don't quite align, but when they do, it is really enjoyable.
Agreed. I know. Well, I think what's hard for me as someone who has a full-time job and then was teaching on the side, like the experience of being in the classroom is my favorite. Mm-hmm. And I could do that all day, every day. It's fitting in the time for like the prep and the grading and the mm-hmm. admin. And that's the piece that doesn't always make it possible for me to teach every semester, but I love to do it when I can.
Yeah. And just like thinking about the hours that go into all that work and translating that into your hourly pay based on the stipend you probably received. It's like, oh, was this worth it? It's fun, but was that worth it?
Financially, it is 100% not worth it. So you have to go into it as like a labor of love, recognizing that, yeah, from like a capitalist standpoint, it's definitely exploitation. Yeah. Down the hourly rate.
Well, it's nice that you have, so it sounds like you have a position that affords you some opportunity to do some of the things that you enjoy. Like in some ways, I think of this as service, right? Of giving back to the community in some regard. And I feel like teaching is a service to, ought to be a service to like the students that we're working with.
Totally. And I have always, I've taught at several different universities over the course of my career. And I have always loved being the instructor who bridges that theory and practice, you know, regardless of what the class is or the subject area, because I think academia is wonderful for so many reasons, but it can be an ivory tower where you're just like really focused mm-hmm. on very myopic topics that like seven other people in the world care about. And there's something that is beautiful about that, that I will always be attracted to and love. But I think a bigger piece of my heart is interested in like, how does this benefit the wider world and the community in whatever way? And so getting students connected to like, you know, we're talking about X topic in the classroom, but like, let's look at what's happening in our community and like go to an event or like do some service learning, or those are the pieces I just love.
Yeah. I very much like tying it into like what they can actually do with this when they graduate. Like, this is why I tend not to teach more like content-based course. I love the applied courses, like methods and statistics and evaluation, because like they hands-on do something. And then that is a skill they can put on their resume and do something with when they graduate. And then thinking about how to make it not this esoteric type approach, but really think like real world, like what this looks like, and not just like pie in the sky ideology of like how we could do research and evaluation, but the difficulty that we often experience when going through these processes, right?
Yes. And the realities of, I think when you're sitting in the classroom, like research methods is a good example where you can like read an article and say like, oh, well, I would have done it like this way. Like, why didn't they do it? You know, have a larger sample or like go whatever. And then I think it's like so helpful to actually like get your hands messy and realize that like most of us do research in a world with like limited resources, right? Like we only have so much time, we only have so much budget, we only, whatever the constraint is, there are many. And so then I think it gives students an appreciation of like why, you know, maybe they weren't able to talk to 300 people in a very specific population in a very specific space, because like, that's not possible.
I had a friend who was lamenting on Facebook about how they got reviews back about like, oh, I wish you'd done the study completely differently. And it's just like, why don't you just review the study for what it did, right? If what they did was just not meritorious, that's one thing. But you can't just go like, yeah, this study would have been so much better if you did X, Y, and Z, and therefore I reject your papers. Like, no, like there are these real world constraints that we have to work with, like access to populations, access to money and time and expertise and all this. And yeah, I wish more people were more understanding when it came to that type of stuff, and more compassionate towards others when thinking about it.
Totally.
Yeah. You've also mentioned you're a public speaker. I would love to hear more about what that looks like for you.
Sure. So I recently have been doing some talks for Profs and Pints, which is started in DC, but has like increasingly been expanding to other cities. And I know other places have other versions of this, but they basically get an academic to give a lecture in a bar. And it's really fun and really accessible. So I have done one on the orgasm gap, which is, I think, a fascinating topic and great to talk about in a bar.
Yeah.
where people just have a chance. So I love it because it's like taking the classroom. It's another version of taking teaching and learning into the community. So the last time I did it sold out, and we actually just yesterday finalized a date to do it in April in Baltimore. So I've been doing that, and then just different, like, you know how in life things just kind of snowball. So like I'm doing that. And then, I mean, there's always the circuit of like academic association related conference speaking. But yeah, I've just been leaning more into like, what does it look like to kind of give talks to different groups in different spaces, which has just been really enjoyable.
Yeah. I love that. Also on the previous podcast that again, isn't out yet at the time of this recording, but we talked a little bit about that and how I have felt like I've been in the evaluation bubble for too long. And now that I'm trying to do some research that kind of takes it outside of that bubble, like I'm realizing how much I have to learn in that. And it's so much fun. It's difficult. And also, like, this is where I want to, this is like that gap I want to build, right? Of like how to promote the field of evaluation among people who aren't evaluators or not in this space. And it's such a rewarding place to be in, to like really think like the public as the audience, as opposed to like this podcast, the evaluators are the audience. And I love evaluators. This is my jam. And also, I'm glad I'm like branching out a little bit more than I have in the past.
Well, and I think for me, it's always fun to think about like, what do different audiences need?
Yeah.
And so for example, the orgasm gap is a topic that I talk about in my sociology of sex and gender class. But at the point in the semester where we talk about it, we've had like 6 weeks of gender theory. And so with the first time I did this talk in a bar, I really spent a lot of time being like, okay, to understand these points, you do need some familiarity with this gender theory, but like, you know, the talk start to finish is an hour. And so like, how do I fit in like 3 minutes of gender theory to like give you the background you need theoretically to understand the rest of what I'm going to say? So I find that a fun puzzle of like, how do, and that's very different, right? Than like a room full of sex therapists or like gender people who have a very different understanding of some of these things. So yeah, that's always a fun thing to think through. Like, what do your non-evaluators need to know
about exactly
whatever evaluation topic?
Yeah. So I'm writing this grant proposal, and that was the issue I was coming up with exactly, was like, when I'm writing for evaluators, I don't need to tell them the benefit of evaluation. I don't need to tell them what it is necessarily. I can just assume that they think about it similarly enough that we can just start as that is the basic knowledge and move from there. And now having to backtrack and think about how do I communicate that within like 1 to 2 paragraphs, because like that's kind of all the space I had for that, is such a challenge. Like, there's so many things I could talk about. What is going to be the most impactful? So they go like, oh, okay, yeah, let me read more, right? Because the first time I did it, I sent it to a bunch of folks who are not in my field to review, and they're just like, I don't understand this. I don't know what this is. Like, wait, why? So I had to completely redo it. And it was great because like they're not in my field, and so like they had this good outsider perspective to really help make sure that I am talking to people outside the field in a way that's understandable.
Exactly. Cause it's so easy to get caught up in like terminology that we think is common knowledge. And then you realize, oh no, that really is my own bubble. And most people don't know about this.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I'm trying to think of like, what would I do if I was in this profs and pints thing, which sounds so fun. And I keep thinking like we have the logic of evaluation activity where you evaluate chocolate chip cookies, right? Well, fun. We could do that with beer while you're in the bar and just have them like evaluate. Maybe the bars wouldn't like that you're in, of like evaluate the beers and stuff like that. Which one's the best? But it could be so much fun to get them really into it and talking about it and thinking about evaluation from a beer perspective as they're drinking while they're learning. That would be so much fun.
You need to pitch this to like whatever the local version is near you, because I think that'd be great.
Yeah, maybe Minneapolis has one. I my little community, I'm in a rural area. We don't have anything like that. Although we do have this Philosopher's Cafe, so our philosophy department / Centers for Ethics, I think. They put on these like monthly cafes at the local brewery. And everybody's welcome. And I haven't been to one yet, but that would be fun. I would really
like
enjoy that.
Sounds like a similar idea. Yeah. It's a fun way to just kind of connect with like different people.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love the topic. I've been really, I don't know if you're familiar, I've been listening to the Pillow Talks podcast.
Ooh, I don't know that one.
And then I haven't read it, but I've heard it. What is it? Emily Nagoski who wrote the book?
Come As You Are.
As You Are. I really want to read that.
Yeah, that's really good. And she also has a podcast. I know you're a podcast fan.
Yes,
like walks through the main findings of the book. So if you don't have time to read the whole book, you can listen to the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And she just published, like in the last couple of months, a new book that I'm trying to blank on the name of, but it's about like sex and long-term relationships that is, I have not read yet, but looks really good.
Yeah, let's see. It is Come Together.
Yes.
Yeah. The Science and Art of Creating Lasting, what's the rest of it? Something. Sexual Connections. Oh, Yeah, I read there, I think it was her and her sister that wrote the book, and her sister, Burnout. That was also a really good book that has been very helpful for me to kind of come out of my path towards burnout, let's just say. And I don't feel like I'm on that path anymore, which is nice.
Good. That is so real. No, it is, especially in our current moment of just like the nature of work and everything is. I currently work in the international development space. So, like, I work with people all over the world, and even just time zones around like when we meet and when emails and Teams chats are coming in, it's like being intentional about your own energy and time that you're working and time that you're stepping away. It's so critical.
Well, let's step into talking a little bit more about the evaluation work that you do. I know we talked before we started recording about your involvement in the systems TIG for AEA and that you're really interested in systems evaluation. So I'm curious what systems evaluate, like what does systems thinking, systems approach look like in your own practice?
Sure. So I work at CARE, which is an international NGO that focuses on women and girls doing like sustainable development and humanitarian assistance. And I have been there for about 2.5 years. And I was hired to lead this, what they call a systems level impact initiative. And it was both thinking about, from an NGO standpoint, a non-governmental organization standpoint, historically, many NGOs do a lot of like direct service delivery. Like someone needs food, we'll provide food assistance. Someone needs cash, let's do a cash transfer. There's a movement in that field to think much more about root causes and the underlying structures that are creating needs in various ways. So how do you do advocacy to create policies so that people in a particular place need less of food or cash assistance? And so I was hired to think about how we measure that, and it has been so much fun. So in my 2.5 years, yeah, we've tried to build out basically an approach for measuring systems level change. And CARE operates in 110 countries. So it is a daunting and exciting challenge because what we're trying to do is have some common things we can measure across the many different types of work we do in many different places that have many different situations. But also make them, to go back to our earlier point, like useful for the program teams in those particular communities and in particular places. And so it's been very iterative. It's been like a very much a learn by doing approach of trying to wrap our arms around this messiness. And so I would say probably, trying to think of timeline here, probably like 1.5 years ago, so maybe about 1 year into my time at CARE, I discovered that there is an AEA TIG around systems measurement. And so I was like, oh, this is who I need to be hanging out with, because this is exactly what I've been trying to do at this large NGO. So this is my second year of my term. So last year was a lot of just kind of learning about what's already been happening and what's going on, and a bit of a rebuilding year. But yeah, this year we're doing a lot. It's actually the 20th anniversary of the systems TIG.
Oh,
So
cool.
there are AEA folks who've been thinking about systems evaluation for 20 years, which is really exciting. So I would say both internally in my own role at CARE, but then also just exposure to how other people are thinking about it across all the different places they are doing this work. It's really challenging to define it in like a couple of sentences. The TIG published a white paper on systems evaluation principles in 2018. So we can certainly share that with people who are interested. But I think it's really, so I will say start with that. It's just that I think it looks probably a little bit differently for different people. I don't actually think there's like a clear consensus on like, oh, systems evaluation equals this. But I would say in general, in my own work, and I think this is common for many others, it's really just thinking about like what are the boundaries and parameters of the system you're looking at, and then trying to understand what happened, like how and why it happened. And what we've been trying to do in my work at CARE is then when possible, estimate how many people's lives are better as a result of that. So let me give you an example. We spent about a year working on an evaluation of CARES response to COVID-19 vaccinations in 34 countries. And we knew that CARE had done like a lot of advocacy and like policy change and work with governments at all levels, from like local community levels all the way up to the United Nations. But if you're thinking about like tracing that through from a systems lens, like, okay, there was all these things happening trying to make vaccine access more equitable and make sure COVID-19 vaccines were available to countries that needed them and get countries like the US to donate vaccines to countries mm-hmm. who needed them. Like, that's all very structural. But to get back to our question of like, how do you know it's worked? At the end of the day, the impact of that would be people got vaccinated against COVID-19. And so, and this is public, like I'm happy to share the link to it. But basically we did this, like literally took us a full year, but this like very multi-prong approach to try and like literally do that logic and then do the estimation of in these countries where care worked, how many people got vaccinated, and try and show CARE's role in contributing to that. So to me, to summarize, I would say systems evaluation is really just, it's like thinking holistically about how and why something operated and looking beyond just like the tip of the iceberg of like, okay, someone got vaccinated in Malawi, but like then kind of tracing that through to like, how and why did they get vaccinated?
Yeah.
You know, where did the vaccines come from? How did that come to be about? That's like probably a muddled, I feel like there's probably a whole class on systems evaluation that someone should be teaching, or maybe exists.
I think so. I do think so. Yeah. I'm curious, like, so there's a lot of challenging aspects of what you're describing to do this evaluation. It took you a whole year. I can understand why. I'm curious, like, what are the methods you're using to determine CARE's impact in this huge system?
So we talk about contribution, not attribution. So especially in the context of systems, organizations are not working alone. They're one of many systems actors, because you're working in coalition, you're working with government stakeholders, there's like lots of groups and entities involved. And so it would be completely disingenuous for an organization like CARE to say like, oh, we alone, mm-hmm. you know, like made vaccines happen. Of course not. That would be right. So silly. So our goal is to say, do we have evidence that CARE meaningfully contributed to this change? And to get into the weeds a little bit, we did a lot of the analysis ourselves in-house based on like programmatic data and then using secondary data sources to try and quantify. But we hired an external evaluator to specifically assess CARE's contribution, because we had an idea of what we thought CARE's contribution was. But as one of my colleagues likes to say, it's like when you say your own children are so cute, and it's like, you know, like I'm the parent, like, of course they're beautiful.
Yeah.
You need someone else, right? You need that external validation. Someone else saying your children are by far adorable. And this is actually interesting and an example of the iteration. So we had some initial estimations of our impact based on what we thought CARE's contribution was. We hired an external evaluator to it was basically like a gut check, right? Like, can you build a theory of like, we've built a theory of change, but can you build a theory of change mm-hmm. based on a review of the documents? And then they also did interviews, bellwether interviews with some stakeholders, where it was a really like qualitative, open-ended process to talk to people who at the time had been in the White House and Congress, relatively high up in like in the administration, well, some other stakeholders, about like, how did we get to the point where the United States was donating vaccines? Because like 2020 feels like a little bit of a black hole. But if you like think back to that as the vaccine was being developed, that was actually like there was a lot of advocacy around that. Yeah. And so in an open-ended way, trying to say like, assess like what was CARE's role in this? Like, did CARE's advocacy do anything in this way, right? Wow. What came out of that was actually care contributed less than we thought. And so that is an example where it's super helpful to have triangulation of different data sources. So we contributed less than we thought in terms of global vaccine equity, but we also got some unintended impact. For example, one of the interviews with someone at the United Nations, we realized that one of CARE's talking points around gender equity actually influenced some key decisions that were made at the UN level. And
Wow.
we would not have known that if an external person hadn't kind of come in to do this interview. So I say all that to say we had this external validation, and then we, as a result of that, actually revised our estimates down because we were like, oh, okay, we got this new information, so we need to make sure all of these pieces that we're doing come together. So it is messy. And I think we now have a framework in place that we're continuing to refine with each successive evaluation. But it's hard. And then I think the other thing we struggle with as an organization is even if you have a phenomenal systems level change win today, CARE started an intervention in Nepal, and then the multiple municipal governments in the country of Nepal have taken it and are now running it, and the system's working better in some way. It's going to be probably 2 or 3 years till I could tell you what the impact of that is, because enough time needs to pass for it to actually be implemented, for budget to be allocated, for people to experience a meaningful change in their life, and for us to be able to actually get to the level of the individual to say, okay, how is your life better and in what way? So I think that is a real challenge of systems related evaluation that if you're interested in impact measurement, which is a lot of my job, there's a time lag between when the thing is that you're evaluating and when you can measure impact. And so again, when you're trying to market your organization or mobilize resources for more funding, it's really nice to have that process be quick. And so that's just an ongoing dynamic we deal with.
Well, what comes up for me when you're talking about the maybe multi-year lag from being able to, understand the impact something has had, but there are things that we could be doing in the meantime, right? Of monitoring activities, of monitoring outputs, and seeing if like th our theory of change is working at the basic level until we can get to the short-term, long-term at outcomes, impacts of whatever it is we're working on.
Definitely. Yes. And actually, I would argue you need everything you just described to be able to measure the impact, because if you haven't documented that along the way, it's an uphill battle to try and go back and retroactively capture some of those milestones. So yes, in an ideal world, all of our programming teams and all of our evaluation teams would be capturing that information along the way. I think the other interesting thing we've learned, though, is that some of our most meaningful systems level changes that we've been able to retroactively measure were not planned and not intended, which because they were responding to something happening in the environment at that time. And so that's just kind of interesting to think about for anyone who works at a nonprofit or an NGO or another organization where you're trying to, you have whatever your mission is around social change and you're trying to build programs or interventions to make specific things happen. But some of this is just really dynamic. And thinking from a systems thinking lens, you're looking at the context of who's involved and the different actors. And all of a sudden, an election happens and someone new is in power or whatever. And so, yeah, it makes there's from an evaluation and monitoring standpoint, it's like an interesting challenge.
I think this is what drew me to the field was the fact that like no one evaluation, no two evaluations will look the same. That like there's constantly this problem solving, and not just to set up an evaluation, but throughout the evaluation, because things don't go perfectly all the time. Very rarely do they go perfectly, right? And so like that's why I love evaluations, because we have all these opportunities to really like think through these challenges and try to navigate these challenges. And it can be really frustrating at the same time. And also, I think it makes it fun.
I have to just tell this brief story. We were doing a systems level impact evaluation in Niger, which is a country in West Africa. And we had spent months prepping because it was just like very complicated with like a lot of different people involved and like several different consulting groups involved. And we were going to do this pretty massive primary data collection effort that included some mixed method studies. So we had like focus groups and interviews, and we also had a household level survey, like pretty large scale for us. And literally the week we were supposed to start data collection, there was a coup in Niger.
Oh my.
And so like, you know, really politically unstable, not safe for like people from outside the country to come in. And it was one of those moments where you're like, oh, it's these months of planning to do this.
Yeah.
And in the end, like, we ended up making it work and, you know, thankfully have some really great local consulting partners who were able to, you know, go in and still collect the data in a way that kept everyone safe. But like in no work plan do you plan for a coup.
Right.
Right. So it's just, is yeah, very much like we live in the real world where messy things happen and you just, yeah, you roll with them and.
Yeah. You figure out how to make it work. Yeah. Oh, this is so cool. I'm curious, is there anything else that like we haven't covered that you're eager to tell our listeners about who you are and how you practice evaluation?
Ooh, what a good question. I don't think so. We have covered a lot of ground. Maybe I'll make a plea.
Yeah.
Which is, and this comes just from my own experience working with a lot of undergraduate students and maybe my own perception, which I shared earlier of like, if you had asked me if I thought this is the field I would be in, I would be like, no.
Right.
I think like research and evaluation is a really exciting space for people who are interested in making social change or who are interested in thinking about how we continue to nudge our world to operate in different ways. I think it has the reputation of being really technical, and there are definitely technical aspects. I also think there's a ton of potential to use evaluation for learning and for storytelling and for really like helping people understand the world differently. Mm-hmm. So that would be my like closing request to listeners is that, and maybe if you're listening to this podcast, you're already bought in, but to the extent you're not, I think there's like a lot of potential to use evaluation for social good. And that is part of what keeps me coming back to it every day.
Yeah. So, like I said, I work in a psychology department. And so most of our undergraduate students, I'd say at least half of them are like, yeah, I'm going to go become a counselor, a therapist, a clinical psychologist, something like that. Great. We need more of those. And also, I think they get this perception that that's the only way that they can make a difference in the lives of other people. And I always try to remind them, like, there are so many other ways we can do that. And I think like that's why I went into evaluation, because I knew clinical counseling was not the route for me. And also I still was really interested in how can I make a positive impact in the world with my unique skill set. And I feel like the evaluation is a great place for that opportunity. So I will echo your plea.
Excellent. No, it is. And I think if you care about, I mean, there's so many different ways evaluation can be useful.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're someone who cares about like philanthropy and donor dollars being used effectively, there's a place for evaluation in that, in terms of like setting up, you know, studies that are taken to feminist and taken to mind power dynamics and are not just donor driven. There are, you know, there's just, we could talk about this for hours, but I just think there's like lots of ways to harness the energy you just talked about in this space.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think one of my earliest my first evaluation, the point of it was to document what this program was doing so that other programs could do the same thing. Because they'd had some impact evaluations showing really good, promising results for this program. But like, how do you teach another program how to do what they're doing without like just taking these people and plopping them into a new context? Right. And so like, that was what we did. We did this ethnographic study to understand this program so that other programs could do similar work. And it was so much fun. And like just so many different ways, right, that we could apply these skills to make a difference in the world.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, Brittany, it was so lovely getting to meet you. I have to thank Hyatt Eskar for recommending you to come on the podcast. I'm glad I got to know you and learn more about the work that you do. And I'm curious, are you going to be at the AEA conference in Portland this year?
I plan to be. So yes, assuming all goes well with funding and all the other logistics to actually get oneself there, I plan to be. So yeah, would love to connect with you if you're going to be there and as well as others.
Wonderful. I hope we could do that. Awesome. Thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you, Dana. This was great. Really fun conversation. So thank you for the thought-provoking question.
Oh, thank you. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please visit the podcast website at evaluland.fireside.fm, where you can subscribe to get notified of new episodes and contact us with your questions, comments, or suggestions. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, this has been Evaluland.